What was interesting about the announcement was that it also said it had secured $150 million in financing by selling something like $170 million worth of notes to an existing investor at a 10% discount. So they went out to their existing shareholder base and they said, hey, who wants to help recapitalize the business? And sure enough, funding was contingent on a number of preconditions, including filing its delayed annual report to regulators and continuing negotiations with a car maker on a joint manufacturing agreement. And a birdie we might have mentioned on this podcast already, that other manufacturer is possibly...
Hi there and welcome to Stock Club. I'm Mike and joining me in today's episode is My Wall Street's chief investor, Emmett Savage. If you like what you hear and want to get more from us, head on over to mywallstreet.com and sign up to our mailing list today to stay in touch. You'll receive a free stock pitch on one of our favorite wide moat businesses. All you need to do is go to mywallstreet.com right now and sign up today. For more information, click on the link in the show notes for this episode. Today's podcast is brought to you by Vodafone Business. Now, if you're like us here on My Wall Street, you know that running a business is difficult. There are countless things to think about and many often simply get ignored or completely forgotten about. That's where Vodafone Business can help. They've crafted a suite of tools and supports to boost your business's operations, and the best part is it's free for everyone. From cybersecurity to harnessing the power of AI, building a website and improving how your teams work remotely, Vodafone Business will help you address the often overlooked but crucial elements for your business's success. To get started today, check out their one-to-one VHub digital support and advice service. You'll find everything you need right there. Find the link in our show notes or simply Google Vodafone VHub for more details. Now, let's get into today's episode. Emmett, how are we doing?
Hey, Mike, what's up?
I have a question for you now. This is a very important question in the grand scheme of things, but as a long-term Tesla shareholder, are you okay and think it's a good thing that Elon Musk takes ketamine all the time?
You know, if I was to list out the things that Elon is guilty of that would jar with my personal belief set, I'd have sold Tesla shares a long, long time ago. Same goes for every crazy scientist. Like if you were to, had you invested in Apple based on how much you would like to work or live with Steve Jobs, sure, no one would have bought shares at all. So yeah, Musk is off doing his own thing. Good luck to him.
Yeah, so if anyone is missing this story, Elon Musk came out, was it the start of this weekend or last week, and says that all the ketamine he takes should be good for investors and they should be happy because it keeps them level or something.
Oh my goodness. He came out yesterday. What was his latest? Oh yes, he kind of was being interviewed on the very important and sensitive subject of racial equality. And it was interesting that he basically said that that the African American cause is one that should be, everyone should just get on with it and look to the future. And it was quite an interesting interview. I don't know who was interviewing. He's probably well known in America. I'd never seen him before, but that was the latest one where I just thought, you know, you're entitled to your opinion. But really, are you a visionary leader or are you just a social and kind of political commentator on whatever is moving at the moment? And he seems to be doing both and everything.
Oh, completely. He's getting so involved with politics now. It's like, what is the point in all of this? Like, do you remember I can't remember which James Bond one it was, but it was your man. The bad guy was the English guy, Price. And he bought a 24/7 news company and then started World War III because he would be able to report on it all the time.
Oh yeah, that's right. Yeah.
I feel like this is Elon Musk's villain era where he just tries to instigate as much conflict online so people will talk about it on Twitter.
Yeah, and it works. It really does.
All right, we're gonna stick on the topic of messy EV stories. We talked about Boeing last week as well. We're kind of staying on the dreary side of things, but you were looking at one particular electric vehicle company in trouble, Emmett.
Yeah, I was, Mike, and I tweeted about it during the week, or I X'd about it during the week. Do we say tweet anymore? Is that a thing? Yeah, we're still okay doing that. I wonder what Elon says. Does he say I X'd during the week? Right, so the EV industry is in such transition and turmoil. It's really a source of a lot of interesting stories at the moment. And there's one hot story that I thought was worth telling, as the company in question is either circling the drain or ready to roll forward, as it were. And the company is called Fisker, which is no surprises, an American car company founded by a Danish automotive designer called Henrik Fisker and his wife Gita Gupta Fisker. And it's a business based in Manhattan Beach, California. So it's a really cool place on a very front end of the cool trends. And it is actually, the business is, Fisker is the successor to Fisker Automotive, which was a business founded in 2007 when it produced the Fisker Karma, which was a luxury plug-in hybrid vehicle. But production was suspended in 2012 because of bankruptcy issues, battery supplier issues. There was a whole myriad of problems there that kind of caused the business to go under. So after that, Fisker Automotive's assets were purchased by a business called the Wangjiang Group in 2014. And then Henrik Fisker himself announced formation of just Fisker Inc. as opposed to Fisker Automotive. So it was, for all intent and purposes, the business, it has been the same one all along, but just a giant red, you know, reset button was pressed about halfway through. So Fisker Automotive was born in 07 and died in 2016. Which is when Fisker Inc. was born. And as I said, all the good stuff from Fisker Automotive remained alive, and all the bad stuff was burned, I guess, in a big barrel out the backyard or whatever the actual process is. And the company itself is known for developing, I suppose its most synonymous vehicle, its equivalent to the Tesla S, is the Fisker Ocean. Actually, no, it's probably more equivalent to the Tesla X, because it's an electric SUV. It has a range of something like 350 miles. And my friend and EV guru, Derek Riley, who we've interviewed twice on the podcast and who I swap texts with regularly about the EV industry, reviewed the car on his YouTube channel about 4 weeks ago. And it's funny, when I went to see what Derek said and a few other reviewers about the actual vehicle, I noticed the heading on Derek's YouTube video was not all that appealing. It's the heading was, did you see it?
Sorry, go on with Derek's first.
Yeah, it said, not the worst car I've ever reviewed.
That's such an Irish way of saying things, because there was a famous YouTuber, sorry, not that Derek isn't a famous YouTuber, but this fella, Marcus Brownlee, who I think he released the YouTube saying it was the worst car he's ever reviewed. And it went bankrupt a month later. I think that's fortunate timing more than anything, but it really shows the impact. I think the stock dropped off a cliff and kept going.
It did, and I watched that one as well, and I hadn't heard of Brownlee, but that's not saying much. I wouldn't be too on top of who's big on YouTube. But I did, Brownlee explained at the start of his video that Fisker tried to stop him do the review because they said, no, wait, we've got a new software update being issued very soon. And he said, well, I don't hold off reviews based on what might be or what's promised. I do a review now. So he had the latest and greatest vehicle, and there was a lot of echoes between his and Derek's reviews, and all the same things were identified. Like, for example, the whole roof of this Fisker vehicle is a solar panel. And they say, Fisker says that you'll get something like 3 to 5 extra miles a day by virtue of the fact that you have this solar panel on the roof of your car, which I think is a neat idea. If you only do short runs, you never even have to plug your car in. So that's kind of cool. But one of the issues that Brownlee identified was the software doesn't even show you how that roof element or the PVs, the photovoltaics on the roof, are actually behaving and what type of charge you're getting from them. So it's not a satisfying user experience. And the best thing that your man Brownlee said was that it was the best backseat he'd sat in. Now, I don't know who assesses the comfort of a backseat when buying a car. It's probably on your list if you're a family person, but
it's probably a rich person thing for someone who can afford a chauffeur, maybe.
That's true, exactly. That's who assesses the backseat. Usually it's only assessed by Rolls-Royce owners. So yeah, so this guy Henrik Fisker, he had a vision that kind of sounds like every other EV manufacturer's or founders, I should say, vision. It's about clean mobility, innovative design, sustainability, striking design, you know, all the usual EV stuff. It could be the sticker on any EV factory's door. However, on March 13th, the Wall Street Journal reported that the business is struggling financially and may file for bankruptcy. And it said that the company had hired restructuring advisors and is looking for additional cash from investors. And problems included lack of sales, manufacturing difficulties, quality issues with its vehicles. And on top of all of that, it's also facing challenges with getting SUVs from Austria to consumers and buyers in the United States. And after the Wall Street Journal published the piece, I was sitting in a car park waiting for my son to come out of a gym on a rainy evening, and I noticed that these shares had just done a nosedive. As I do every day, I just look at the gainers and losers for the day, the top five gainers and losers, to see if eventually my brain spots a trend in the biggest drops in a day and the days subsequent. Anyway, I noticed Fisker had fallen off a cliff. They'd fallen 46% in after-hours trading on Wednesday, after the Wall Street Journal published that piece. So I suppose after all that news. Then on March 18th, which is the day after Paddy's Day here in Ireland and is a national holiday here, the company said it was pausing production for 6 weeks as it continued. What was interesting about the announcement was that it also said it had secured $150 million in financing by selling something like $170 million worth of notes to an existing investor at a 10% discount. So they went out to their existing shareholder base and they said, hey, who wants to help recapitalize the business? And sure enough, funding was contingent on a number of preconditions, including filing its delayed annual report to regulators and continuing negotiations with a car maker on a joint manufacturing agreement. And a birdie told me, a birdie we might have mentioned on this podcast already, that other manufacturer is possibly Nissan in Japan, but let's see how that works out. So their cash on hand, the business's cash on hand had fallen to about $89 million as of March 15th. So just a few days ago, let's just say $90 million. At the end of December, it had $325 million, which gives us a pretty decent insight into the burn. I mean, that business has burned, $210 million. So like, no, $230 million in the intervening time. And that's a serious cash burn. And on top of that, the company is also continuing to negotiate this potential transaction, which could include an investment in Fisker. And if there's a joint development for one or more of its EV platforms, the business might just get through the gap. And on Monday, shares sank 16%. They've fallen 90% this year. And if all of that wasn't bad enough, I guess the sales growth left it with 5,000 unsold vehicles at the end of last calendar year. And the chief executive, Henry Fisker, said that the company's strategy was intended to better weather the financial pressures of other new EV companies face. But instead of owning its own assembly plant and employing factory workers, it pays other manufacturers to build cars. And this decision was supposed to keep Fisker's operating costs lower and boost profitability and give it put it at the front end of the rollout machine that we look for in a good EV investment.
That's interesting because we were talking about other cars. There's obviously bargains. A lot of EV companies have been suffering, these startups. I remember around the SPAC boom. I'm not sure if Fisker was one of them, but I think Google was the fastest company to reach 100. Is it 10 billion in revenue? 10 billion in revenue in whatever it was, 8 years. And I think in the space of like 6 months, five EV companies said they would reach 10 billion in revenue in 6 or 7 years, less time anyway. So they break the record. So I'm not saying Fisker is one of them, but there was a lot to come out.
There was one, Lordstown Motors, and they were, their projections for revenue growth were so off the hook. As far as I know, Lordstown has gone under since, but they had like just, hypergrowth doesn't even describe what they had anticipated. They anticipated everyone would have a Lordstown car in their front drive and their back garden and one in the shed as a spare.
Yeah, but the fact that Fisker doesn't actually own its own manufacturing plants and everything makes it a less attractive buy than, you know, if Nissan or another big OEM would come in and kind of catch a bargain deal and elevate their own electric vehicles or just kind of take over and add their own efficiencies. But if they're just putting parts together, you know, and it's a brand, that's not as attractive an acquisition. So what's your take on Fisker and the environment in general?
Well, as you said last week, we discussed Boeing and Airbus's effective duopoly. And between those two big manufacturers, they have a 65% market share. So this kind of trend exists all throughout the business world and the commercial world. And it looks like Tesla and BYD are the equivalent, if you like, of Boeing and Airbus. Certainly when you look at EV or nearly pure EV play companies. And then there's the other ones like Volkswagen, GM. But from not a carburetor to have ever been seen perspective, the whole play is China versus America. But what I always think about when I look at any company, and I studied this years back, 2006, when I did a master's of strategy, shout out to Professor Robert Gallivan, was the economic rule of three, which is also known as the rule of three and four. It's a very interesting little framework for considering a business. And this economic rule of three suggests that in a mature and competitive market, there's really only three major players. There tends to be only three major players. And these major players control a significant portion of the market, which is usually 70 to 90% combined. And it's not a strict rule. The exact number three is not set in stone. And I'm going to try and give you a few examples. And there can be situations with just two players, or there can be four players. But the overall idea is that a small number of companies dominate any mature market. And it's really good to be aware of this as a long-term investor, to think about, will this company rise to become one of the dominant three, or does it have a first mover advantage in a business or an industry, rather, that it clearly is going to hold that top three position? Or will it be acquired by one of the big three? Or will it carve out a space to act as a little boutique player? Because this economic rule of three allows for lots of boutique players that do something small and niche, or niche, as they say in America. And a few examples to bring it to life is the soft drink industry. So there's Coca-Cola, PepsiCo, and maybe Dr. Pepper, or maybe what's the energy brand called? Red Bull. Like, there's these Red Bulls. Exactly. When you think of smartphones, there's Apple, Samsung, and Huawei, although Huawei's position is challenged in America due to sanctions, but it is a mega player in the handset market. You think about credit cards, Visa, MasterCard, and Discover. When you think of runners, as we say here, or sneakers, there's Nike, Adidas, and Puma, and then there's the challenger brands coming up. Burger chains, McDonald's, Burger King's, Wendy's, PlayStation, Nintendo, Xbox. Like, it seems that the everything that you consume is grouped into one of two or one of three. And as I say, it isn't necessarily always three. There can be variations. Like, there's the big four in the consulting firm, McKinsey, BCG, Bain, and Deloitte. I think they're the big four. Accounting firms, there's PwC, Deloitte, EY, and thank you, KPMG. So there's four there. And then there's regional variations to this rule, like Xiaomi, which is a Chinese smartphone player in China. So it's very well known over there. It pretty much isn't known outside of China, but that market is obviously ginormous, but it doesn't hold the same, you know, brand awareness as Apple or Samsung out of China, but inside the country, it's as well known as Apple. So when we look at a business and bringing it back to Fisker, you kind of wonder, is this going to be one of the big three? Will it be acquired by one of the big three, or will it independently act to survive in its own little niche? And that's the question.
Yeah. Okay. So if you're putting, say, Tesla and BYD as the two main leaders in the, we'll say, pure EV play, because obviously the legacy OEMs have their own EV kind of operations going, what would you think is the third to come in?
Yeah, I'd say most of our listeners would agree with Tesla and BYD. And if you live in Ireland, and if you live in South Dublin, you're going to see BYDs everywhere. They've just suddenly happened. I swear to God, everywhere you look, there's a BYD. So Tesla's no surprise, and BYD have just arrived over here and I'm sure are well bedded down in the US. I think the third is probably NIO, which is another Chinese auto manufacturer, and it focuses on premium electric vehicles. And their sales number are, of course, lower than Tesla's, but are growing really steadily. And I'm pretty certain Derek answered this question on the podcast, and I can't remember what he said. Do you remember, Mike?
Derek, I asked him for one outside of Tesla, and he said BYD, in fairness, so.
He said BYD, yeah, I do remember that, yeah. Yeah, so in fairness, I certainly would not, there's no way I'd bet on Fisker being one of the big three. It sounds like they'll do a deal. They 100, when you've burned, you know, some like $250 million since Christmas, and you've raised a note for $150 million, it's really just a few gulps of oxygen while you get it figured out, even though they've stopped their fabrication and they've told everybody to sit down or whatever, furloughed or whatever way they've dealt with it. But it just doesn't sound like a business on the front foot. And when you, if we were saying, you know what, all the economics and all the practicalities of the business completely suck, but the car is loved and beautiful and innovative and it's just easy on the eye, you'd say, yeah, there might be something there. But alas, all of those elements are missing. So, it might get saved. It's now pennies. I can't even remember what the market cap is. But it might be saved, but it just wouldn't get me too excited. And I don't think it's going to be a brand that's going to be very relevant or dominant in the years ahead.
Yeah, that's fair enough. And then I think there's going to be a bit of an electric vehicle graveyard over the next 5-10 years of those companies that had great ambitions, but maybe more ideas than actual execution. I think we're going to see a lot fall off. I think we're going to see a lot of cheap acquisitions. Watch this space. Okay, quick reminder, folks, from our friends at Vodafone Business, check out their free one-to-one digital support and advice service today to discuss a range of topics from social media tips, cybersecurity, building a website for your business, and everything else you can think of. Search Vodafone VHub or click on the link in the show notes.
I have a note on that now. So I was at the Ireland versus Scotland game in the Aviva, and I saw, you know, that strip light that goes around Vodafone VHub was going all the way around. And I said to my wife, oh, look, that's happened because of my podcast. They're actually, wow. And they forgot the important strap line. Just go in and talk to them. I was like, they didn't get it. Let's just go in and talk to them. Anyway, it's nice to see the impact of our advertising slot on our podcast has made it to the strip lighting in the Aviva. Hats off, Vodafone.
We're really pushing that multi-billion-dollar company's advertising budget on this little podcast alone.
We certainly are, and happy to do it. And another word from our other sponsor, which is ourselves, just put your email into it. Look, folks, it's very simple. Go to mywallstreet.com and put your email into the email field at the top. Why? Because we'll send you stuff. Why do you want stuff? Because it's valuable. Just do it. It's simple, so simple. Put your email in, stop your messing, pull in your card, do it now. That's a plug. Okay, I'm finished with that. Mike, Mike, I'm going to ask you about some rumors. And it's that Apple is tapping up Google to be its go-to generative AI solution, which is really unbelievable. It has, in my mind, parallels of how I think most people use Google Maps, even though they have an Apple phone. And now Apple is talking to Google about generative AI. So could you talk to me first about this potential partnership?
Yeah, there's a lot to take in with this. It's important to know, first of all, talking about rumors, it's not a done deal at all. Bloomberg reported that Apple is actually still in talks with Microsoft and OpenAI too, but it very much feels like Google is a front runner, which obviously makes a lot of sense considering Google pays Apple, it's reported, about 20 billion quid a year to be the default browser on all of Apple's devices, essentially. So if we're seeing generative AI as an extension of search, because a lot of people are, you know, it seems like it's just a continuation of an existing deal. So it'd be very hard for Microsoft and OpenAI to muscle into that. I also think there could be a bit of ring fencing with, you know, the big, like for Apple, Google is this known entity that it's worked with before, whereas OpenAI is kind of this scary new entrant, and it might be coming to threaten their threaten their dominance in tech as a whole. So it's not surprising. So basically, Google's answer to ChatGPT is Gemini. It was originally called Bard. It's definitely not as widespread as ChatGPT at the minute. I think there's a few things behind that. Obviously, OpenAI is a smaller company. They're able to release stuff faster. Google, there's a lot of bureaucracy. Like, it's not like Google were sitting on their hands when OpenAI released ChatGPT. They had all this technology there. They had DeepMind AI and everything else. But there was probably a reticence to release something that wasn't fully ready, which is ironic because Google Gemini got in trouble there last month. Did you see this? It kept like inaccurately depicting the race.
Oh, I did. Yeah, and there was something about World War II, and they said something about the Nazi. Give me a picture of four Nazis or something, and it was multicultural and multiracial. Is that right?
Yeah, strange stuff. Like you could say, show me a picture of a Viking from Norway in 900 AD, and it would be like a Native American person or something. And it was very like it was very strange, and it was obviously programmed into the system and whatever. So it was a bit of a faux pas, and obviously the Elon Musk of the world took that as the biggest woke, worst thing in the world that could ever happen, which gave it legs too. But so that's the guts of the deal at the minute. I can't really say too much on it yet, but that's just a really big deal, I suppose, if it does go through.
Well, what does it say? I suppose, what does it say about Apple's own AI capabilities? Look, I don't know about you, Mike, but I think Siri is awful. I've disabled it on all my devices. I don't trust it. I don't trust it to get it right. So talk to me about Apple's own AI.
Yeah, it doesn't look good at first glance, does it? Apple have been saying that they're going to power a lot of the features in the upcoming iOS 18 with their own AI features, but it all seems quite internal. So like, say how you would interact with other apps on your phone or within the iPhone world, if that makes sense. So do you know what I mean? If you're addicted to social media and you turn off Twitter, it might immediately turn on Instagram or something like that, you know? Or if it knows you're about to turn off your alarm 10 minutes before when you're already awake or something like that. But it seems to need a partner to do the heavy lifting when it comes to the generative AI, which, you know, writing out an essay or creating an image or what we've called, you know, this essentially this extension of search, because it doesn't seem to have the capabilities. I'm not sure how I feel about that. You can argue to the point that was hardware first and is happy to sit out of certain fights, like search engines was the obvious one, which seems to be right to do because Microsoft, I don't know how much money Microsoft spent trying to keep up with Google and just couldn't. But just considering how important AI is to the world of tech, I'm not sure it's something that they can just choose to sit out of. It is developing its own large language model called IX or Ajax, if you're in America. But apparently it's well behind competitors. And I would see this as a point of concern that a company with Apple's resources is so far behind that they have to go out to what is essentially a competitor and integrate them into all their devices. Maybe it's a stopgap until IX does catch up. I'm not sure.
But it does show as well obviously AI has its complexities, but to do it well, quote unquote, is something else, because like we can all take a shot at AI. There's a lot of exposed APIs out there for businesses big and small to interact with AI and deploy it. And then we have businesses, whether it's Perion or I'm just thinking there's endless companies that have put AI central to their storyboard, CrowdStrike, Perion, they're all there. But when you think about the application at the end user in the retail space, it's really difficult just to nail it. And you were spared, I presume, Windows 95 through virtue of your age. But I remember when Windows 95 was rolled out, at the bottom of Microsoft Word and Microsoft Excel, there was this little paperclip character who you might have seen in pop culture. Clippy, was it? Right. So it was the biggest pain in the arse because basically this clip was trying to predict what you needed to do with 100% error guaranteed. Like the guy couldn't guess anything right. But to get him out of the way, and he was over helpful, over chirpy, over in the way. You're trying to drag him, trying to close him, trying to get rid of him as a feature. And this was AI minus 29 years. And even now, when I think of Clippy, and I think that the new Apple iOS 18 is going to be AI powered, I have nightmares of Clippy or whatever his name is reappearing going, hey, looks like you're trying to open TikTok. Would you like to see Snapchat? It's like, no, go away. Get out of my way. I don't want to see it.
That'd be great branding if, because Microsoft are obviously wanting to integrate the generative AI into all their products. If they had brought Clippy back for Excel and everything. But it was actually good, like, knew what was happening.
Well, if he had his act together and he did actually add value, sure, come on back, Clippy. He's a nice little chap and very friendly to look at. But, I mean, come on. Anyway, look, Kamir, how big of a deal? I know this is not deal or big, no big deal, but is this a big deal for Google?
Huge. Huge. It seems to be a big line in the sand. Obviously, if it goes through, that is. It would be pretty devastating if Microsoft and OpenAI actually landed this deal in the end, considering Google and Apple's existing relationship. But if it does go through, and I'm kind of saying this as if it does, it'll essentially get 2 billion users overnight if it becomes a standard on Apple devices. So that's not bad. But I think more importantly, obviously 2 billion users is always going to be the most important thing, but it means that the tech is clearly at least on a par with OpenAI. So ChatGPT made all the headlines. We talked about why it was able to be released earlier than anything Google came out with. And Google was left almost being reactive. But there was real talk that this could be the first legitimate threat to Google's search dominance, especially because it took so long for Google to come out with something else. And then that was barred and barred kind of here and there. And now Gemini is here. And so if Gemini comes out and immediately gets this Apple deal, it's like, okay, yeah. That was fun while it lasted, but you know, Google is still Google. So yeah, it'll be cool. To see it bring the tech to the masses in this one fell swoop would be huge. The one thing that might be a roadblock to the whole thing is regulators. So Google's original deal with Apple it's already under review by the Department of Justice, I think. It's because it essentially creates a search monopoly. If Apple were to essentially hand Google an extension of that monopoly on generative AI, doesn't really help their case. Interestingly, though, on this point, Google's main argument in that case is that their search engine is superior to anything else out there, and Apple just wants the best for its iPhone users, which is probably a fair argument. That's not... Is that as accurate when... ChatGPT is there, and OpenAI's kind of generative AI is right there. Is it as clear? I wonder. So yeah, it's all a lot up in the air, but big potential if it does come through. I don't think anything's going to be announced until June. So Apple holds its annual Worldwide Developers Conference around then. So it'll be an interesting one to watch. The market's kind of reacted as if it's already done, and the market is. Usually, not always, but usually right on these things. It would be pretty devastating if Apple turned around to OpenAI instead. But what they can do is just make it a not exclusive deal so they can kind of use both. Considering the scale, that would be very possible too. So yeah, a lot up in the air, but a big deal if it does come through.
Certainly is. I was at an online lecture last night with a psychologist, I think it was. Very, very interesting, and investing in psychology. But he said something that I thought was, I'd say who it is to give him credit, but I actually don't remember. He's a professor from UCD and fascinating character. But he said that attention is the new gold. So back in the days of gold mining, this the gold was obviously the resource, but now businesses, they know that people's attention is in fact the new gold, and that every single producer of an app is there to mine for your attention. And they will do whatever it takes to keep your attention. So whether you choose all the obvious examples like TikTok and Instagram, that they're clearly looking to keep your attention, as is Netflix and as are all the radio stations. But when you go down the curve or the long tail, every business is mining for your attention. And I think that that's articulated in what you just said, Mike. But in reality, whereas Apple are saying they want, you know, what's best for their users, what they want is the users to stick around and use their products longer. And it's obvious that that makes sense as a business.
Big time. You're talking about that, and it just reminded me of a story from Matt Levine this week or last week. He always talks about crypto kind of, I wouldn't even say critically, almost amusingly critically. But basically, all these meme coins are going crazy at the minute. Like, you know, people are making millions off a meme coin called Dog with Hat. But there was a meme coin called Splunk, I think. And basically, the guy who set it up, Splurg, basically lost 10 million of a bunch of people's money who put it in. I don't know how he lost. I think basically because everything is anonymized, he lost, you know, the details of it, and he can't just go out and get it again. But of course, the meme coin, because it got all the attention of the guy who set it up losing all the money, went up like 5,000% on the first day because there was attention on it, and it had eyes. So in spite of everything, it actually worked. So yeah. That's obviously an extreme case, but when it comes to attention, yeah, that's mad.
Isn't it just, look, we could talk about it all day, and I wish we could, because honestly, it's such an interesting subject. There's so many things about the whole movement of AI that just merit an all-day chat, but let's push on. I think you're going to give us an elevator pitch, Mike. What's going down? Actually, I looked at Garmin after you pitched it last week, and I don't mean from a stock perspective. I meant from a device perspective. I thought, oh yeah, I'm going to get something to keep an eye on my VO2 Max. They're expensive. They are expensive watches. I didn't realize. I thought it'd be like in the same ballpark as a Fitbit, but it's like, I think the entry level product I was looking at was like €600.
Yeah, they've got the high end market. But no, this isn't a repitch on Garmin. I looked at a UK company called Cerillion. Software company provides tools to kind of operate billing, charging, invoicing, and CRM solutions. Trades on the LSE under the ticker CER. Its main customers are actually in the telecoms industry. So I was wondering, did you ever come across these guys at Vodafone, or was that maybe after your tenure there?
No, never. I mean, I left Vodafone over 10 years ago. So no, not a bit. But it's funny, I tell you where I did come across the name. It popped out of our Nexus engine. And I was very surprised because I'd never heard of it. And for you to say it now, I'm like, very interesting. So you've independently found it. Nexus has pointed at it. I wouldn't be shocked. Well, I'm dying to hear what you have to say. Tell me about it.
Yeah, so it's one of, you were talking about niches earlier, and this is kind of a bit of a riches and niches story. So it's built itself a little niche with the specialist software for what are huge businesses. Do you know what I mean? The telecoms industry as a whole, it's multi-billion dollar companies. So due to the size of this customers, it kind of gets to pen these long-term contracts, which is great for predicting revenue and earnings growth. And I think it's about 80% of customers have been there for over 5 years. So for software, that's pretty serious. So given how complex these businesses are, there's a lot of switching costs involved. You can imagine changing the billing instructor for Vodafone and how that would go and how big of a project that would be. So it does have some decent barriers to entry there. I think because of your Nexus comment, these numbers are going to make a lot more sense. So there's a lot to like at first glance. It's around $600 million market cap, growing revenue at about a 20% mark, big insider ownership. And that's because the founder is there, Lewis Hall. He's still the CEO. We obviously love to see founder-led businesses that typically outperform for a number of reasons. The main one being that just leadership has a long-term vision, and it's not taken up by short-termism. Do you know what I mean? It's usually they're one of the largest shareholders, if not the largest shareholder. So your interests are closely aligned with the CEO, which is always important. The CEO was talking about building a company, making bigger over 10 years, not hitting next quarter's targets. So in a very small nutshell, that's why we like founder-led businesses. Really nice returns on capital over the past 3 years. I'd say this is why it popped up on Nexus. Return on invested capital was 60% for 2023. So put a euro in the top, get 160 out at the bottom at the end of the year. It's not bad. It's got a small dividend. Obviously, a company like this, the dividend isn't really going to be the top priority. I think the payout ratio is only about 25%. So,
which is very typical for the London Stock Exchange. I mean, it's almost a rite of passage. If you're going to list on the LSE, you've got to pay a dividend.
Yeah, But with the payout ratio only 25%, there's a lot of room for improvement there if that's where management wants to go. I think the big risk factor I see after a kind of quick glance is that its customers would have a lot of pricing power or buying power, as we say, which is one of the kind of one of the big threats for a smaller supplier to big enterprises. And we talked about this with the car supplier we talked about 3 weeks ago where
wasn't Autoliv, it was the other guys, they do the seats, right?
Yeah
it was the seat manufacturer. I remember them. We said we could assemble a car if we just got it. Yeah, I remember the guys, we all do. Don't worry, we don't need their name. We know them.
So I think Cerulean's customer count is only about 80 in total, which means on average, each contract is worth about $500,000 in revenue every year. So obviously, some are going to be a lot bigger and some are smaller. But when there's that much like importance on each deal and when you're dependent on a few big contracts, it leaves you a bit exposed when it comes to negotiation. All in all, a very solid business, not outrageously priced. It is reasonably expensive, but it's got the kind of software margins to back it up. So that's Cerulean. If you are in the UK, I know we got a lot of UK investors and obviously Ireland as well with DEGIRO and everything else. It's definitely one to stick on your watch list and do your own research first. So,
Mike, I really love that pitch for all the reasons that you just outlined. But I also like it because I'm not put off by 80 customers. And I'm not going to put you on the spot, but the real question is, does any of those 80 customers have more than, let's say, contribute more than 5% of to the revenue line? So is there one or two or three customers that make up the lion's share of that revenue? And that's for our listeners to go and research. But I think having 80 customers is pretty impressive in a world where decisions are made slow. And as you rightfully pointed out, contracts are cancelled even slower. Like, it's a very, very, very sticky product. If you get into an opco or into a telecoms operator and you play a critical role in their billing system, the probability of being swapped out, if you do what you do reasonably well, or even just average, is very, very low. So I do like Cerulean. You've put it right up the top of my own research list, and I'm going to have a look at what's coming down the pipeline in Nexus. I wouldn't be surprised if it's there for you and I to kind of give a sign off to. So nice call. Great pitch.
Okay, that's where we'll finish up. Before we do, though, just a thank you to our friends at Vodafone Business. If you're a business owner in need of a leg up when it comes to your digital transformation, get yourself over to Vodafone VHub to book your appointment today. And Emmett, where do you go?
Go into Vodafone and say Mike sent you.
You can find the link in our show notes. That's it for today's show, Emmett. Thank you, as always. And thank you, everyone, for listening in. And a special shout out, actually, to one listener from Canada, Drake. Thank you for sending in a lovely message. I hope you're enjoying all of Horizon and my Wall Street's products. And yeah, it's great to get a little message into Luke. I'm sure he sends them on. He only sends on the good ones, not the complaints we get about this podcast. But thank you very much for your kind message.
Yeah, well said, Mike. I saw that message, and you're right. That was a really touching message from Jake Newfield, who said amongst all the lovely things, he said, I should tell everyone to just go to our website and put their email in the top. But no, joking aside, thank you, Drake. It was a very thoughtful and well-composed message, and it really was nice to get the feedback.
Yeah, and Drake from Canada, if you are a particular Drake from Canada, I don't think you are, but if you are, like, just a quick shout out on like your socials would be good. If we had 100 million followers.
There's always an ask, isn't it? Like, God, why can't we just say thank you? I've literally said here, put your email in our field, and you're like, here, do it.
But I don't think you are Drake the rapper. So thank you anyways. Okay, yeah. And that's it for today's show. Remember, sign up to mywallstreet.com to hear more from us.